but it's fun to take risks. And one of my initial impressions of Ed Lindemann is that he's a risk taker. He's rooted in Christ. He's an elder in the Presbyterian Church. He's had 5 different careers thus far, all intentionally chosen. He was in airplane manufacturing, in electronics. He was the director of the program planning for the Apollo Space Project. He was president of Whitworth College in Spokane. He recently resigned. He will be becoming a president emeritus at the school and will be living in Spokane, but will be giving full-time work to the future and futuristics. I like to kind of read people by their handshake, and I would love to know how he gets the rawhide sort of hands he has. Are you a wood chopper or a... Working with your hands, okay. But he has strong hands. I sense he's a strong person in Christ. He's also a needy person in Christ. I asked him what he wanted out of our time together. And one of the things he said was, whenever I come to an experience like this, I see it as sort of a school. And I'm there like a sponge to soak up anything I can to help me more fully understand the church and how I can help the church to be the church in the world. Ed Lindemann.
I move around a lot. Maybe I need to hang this around my neck eventually because it'll be hard for me to stay right here, I'm sure. As I was sitting over there, there was a little baby boy about 6 months old sitting a few feet from me. And the thought that went through my head was that this little lad will live longer in the 21st century than in the 20th century. That he will see the year 2000 at age probably, say, 20. And that he will probably have another 80 years to go into the 21st century. And I would suspect that his children will land on the moons of Jupiter to measure those volcanoes that are very active on those moons right now. That the young people in our midst really are the future present. My goals for this time this afternoon with you, and I have 3 times with you, my goals for this first time is just simply to introduce the idea of future studies to you. What is futuristics? I got into it back in about 1963, 64, and at that time you were an oddball if you belonged to the World Future Society and talked about the future and were considered a futurist. But in the last 15 or 20 years, that has changed dramatically, in that the study of the future is now very much a legitimate activity. I wrote a book last year, and in it I think I said something like that. It just dawned on me now, if I can find it. Thinking in the future tense is no longer a sideshow circus having to do with fortune tellers and crystal balls. As stated in the recently published document of the World Future Society, An Introduction to the Study of the Future, here's a quotation. It's very important. What was once regarded as a peculiar gift of the prophet or of the special talent of the science fiction writer, the ability to describe the future, is now increasingly seen as a needed, legitimate, and exciting field of intellectual endeavor. And so my goal this afternoon is simply to introduce you to the idea of future studies, to talk about it philosophically, and maybe even theologically, if there's time to get into that and all. One thing about the future is that ultimately we have to decide what kind of future we prefer. Gary asked me a little while ago why I thought the study of the future was so important. And the real quick answer was that we in the religious community, believers in Jesus Christ, have let the secular futurists steal from us the ultimate question, which is, where are we going? For 2,000 years, the Christian faith has set the vision of the future. Jesus Christ is the future made present. The power of God in the present reveals itself in our commitment to Him. But it also reveals itself in our commitment to the will be of Jesus Christ. Revelation is not over, and frankly, it's just barely underway. A measly 2,000 years worth. And in the whole spectrum of time, that isn't very long. There is much more to come. And so we have set before us what God intends. The future is three things. What God intends, what persons working together make possible, and what you do. And I've come to the realization recently, actually it just dawned on me, that we in the church go to the secular futurists. Now, I'm not downgrading the secular futurists, the Herman Kahns, the Willis Harmons, the Alvin Topplers, and I know most of them quite well. Alvin Toffler starts out his lectures, "I'm an atheist," and so forth and so forth. Hazel Henderson starts out her lectures, "and I've had no religious upbringing." Herman Kahn doesn't say anything about it. He just ignores it completely. And yet those are the people that we hear about and read about. The Lutheran Brotherhood had a big seminar down in Phoenix last year. The insurance company, remember that? Who did they bring in? They spent a fortune bringing in all the great futurists. And I said to myself, isn't that interesting? Portion of the religious community asking the secular community, where are we going? We must do that future imaging together as both a secular community and a religious community. And so one of my goals is to try to help you as a part of the, what I'll call broadly the religious community, to come to at least a brief understanding of what the study of the future is all about. And then when we leave at the end of our 3 days, you'll say to yourself, gee, I think I do have a responsibility to concern myself about the future. Just let me scope a little bit about the what's going on, and this is just data at this point, what's going on in the United States in the area of future studies. Now let me just zip off a few, so you know that it's not something that's just a casual thing in our society, as it was 10 years ago. There is a law in Congress now that requires that every standing committee of Congress have on it a futurist. Bet you didn't know that. Very important step. That step, that law was passed 3 years ago, and they're just now learning how to deal with it. In 1974, a group of congressmen got together, started by Charlie Rose in North Carolina, and began an informal group, not a government organization, but an informal group now that calls itself the Congressional Clearinghouse on the Future. Every single Wednesday, congressmen and their staff people meet together specifically to listen to people who come in to talk about certain aspects of the future. 1 month it'd be the future of art, 1 month it'd be the future of space exploration or whatever. Simply to raise the awareness of the future in the minds of our political leaders. A very important step. I've been there, I know what they do. Every month they put out a paper called What's Next. It's a very fine publication. And that's helping us to think in terms of the future. The World Futures Society, I joined it in 1965 when it had less than 1,000 members. We had a mimeograph sheet every 2 or 3 months. Now there are 30,000 members all over the world, and a very fine magazine every other month comes out. Congress passed a law in 1972 creating an Office of Technology Assessment, it's called OTA, who it's a staff of about 50 people, who have been assigned by Congress to make a predetermination of the social, economic impact of technological change before it happens. In other words, to take congressional laws or whatever, try to predict what will happen if that in fact did become a law. In other words, have an anticipatory mode with respect to research and development in our country. You can now get master's degrees and PhD degrees in the field of future studies. University of Southern California, University of Minnesota, University of Houston. And so it's important that those of in the church who have the most specific vision of the future there is on the planet Earth need to learn something about it. And so that's one of my goals with you today. I used to live in I grew up in a very small town in Iowa, 400 people. I wouldn't trade my childhood for anything. Every morning, a train would come through town, whistle at the stop at the crossing. And every night when it came back about 5 o'clock, the time I picked up the Des Moines Register Tribune to deliver, it came back and whistled at the crossing. Today, 50 years, 40 years later, every single time that I hear a train whistle, I am pulled back to that moment in my life. I am linked to the past daily in one way or another. And all of us have different ways by which we're linked to the past. When I see a baby in an airplane or at a conference, I look on that baby's face and I say, someday that baby will be in a spacesuit helping to mine the moon. And so that links me to the future. We all have ways by which we are linked to the past and to the future. Now, I'm going to read something out of the preface here. There are two poles of life, past and future. Each of us has different symbols which hitch us to the past and the future, and yet we live in the present. Regrettably, most of our consciousness is dotted with representations of the past. We have been oriented to the past. But now that we have the technical skills to invent a completely new world, we must increasingly and quickly become more oriented to the future. Quite simply, we must learn to think in the future tense. We now have a new understanding of the fact that we are able to construct the future. And that has not always been true. You go back far enough, no one concerned themselves with the future. The future was simply going to be a repetition of the past. Well, there were some, but for the main 98% of the people were thinking that the future would be the same as the past. Then, so we're now able to change the future. Now we must decide whether to or not. We have to decide, are we going to do something about that? And once we decide that, we have to decide how to. And then we have to make the ultimate decision, which is, what kind of future do we want? So there's 4 points. We're not able to construct the future. We have to decide whether we will involve ourselves in that, then how we're going to involve ourselves in that, and then what kind of future we want. My wife and I were invited to a retirement home in Spokane a few weeks ago. This retirement home has about 200 people in it, and the average age is 85. We were invited to have dinner with them, and then they asked me to give a talk on the future of space exploration. And there's just no way I would turn down an opportunity to do that in that context. Any group of 85 to 90 year old people who want to talk about the future of exploration can have me anytime, and I love to speak on that subject. Before dinner, or at dinner, we sat at a table with about 6 people. The couple across from us were in their 90s, the woman on my right was 91, the people over here were 83. My wife and I in our 40s. At the end of the dinner, the woman on my right handed me a little 3x5 card on which she had typed something. And she looked me straight in the eye and she said, I thought you would like to have this. She said, I was going through some of my things this afternoon, thinking about your talk tonight, and I typed this on this piece of paper for you. Let me read what she had on that piece of paper. I meant to bring it with me. It was taken from a December 10th, 1913 issue of the Deer Park Union. Now, Deer Park is a town of 1,000 people north of Spokane, a half an hour. You know how they used to do in the small town newspapers, the little news items about 3 lines each? Well, this was taken from a news item about the Deer Park Literary Guild. And it said, the Literary Guild is going to have a debate on Saturday night. And their subject is, be it resolved that the gunny sack is of greater use than baling wire. Thank you. I looked at that and I said to myself, what is this woman trying to tell me? And I thought for, I'm sure, 2 or 3 minutes. In fact, I put it down by my plate and all, and I acknowledged it, and suddenly it hit me. Do you know what she was trying to tell me? The future isn't what it used to be. The future isn't what it used to be. I mean, that's a powerful message. Compare that gunny sack, you know, to manned exploration of the moons of Jupiter in 20 or 30 years. The future they had then isn't what the future we have now. How do we learn to think in the future tense? I'm sure all of you have a piece of paper and pencil, you better have. If you don't have, borrow one as best you can, or remember it as best you can. Because I want to break you up for a minute or two. Some of you got up at 3 o'clock this morning, and I can see that in your eyes. On the top of a piece of paper or in your mind, and you'll be in a small group where you can share that so that each person can have you'll have access to this. On the top of a piece of paper, write 1989. And then opposite, in code, you can write how old you will be in 1989. If that doesn't shock you, nothing else will. That hurts, doesn't it? Now, in a little column, write these words, just in a column, and leave room to the right of each of them to write something. The first word is need, N-E-E-D. The second word is fear. The next word is hope for. The next one is work at. The next one is learn from. And the next one is believe in. Now, alone, individually, I want you to take the next 3, 4, 5 minutes, putting opposite each of those words the answer, based on the fact that you were in 1989. Project your mind into 1989 when you're age XX and say, what will I need? And put a word or two opposite. What will I hope for? What will I fear? What will I learn from? What will I work at? What will I enjoy? Put those words down there, and you will not have to share these with anybody unless you want to, so please be honest with yourself. Don't feel you have to give those away unless you want to in a minute or two. I'm going to give you 3, 4, 5 minutes to put those down, and then I'll ask you to do something else. Now, stay where you are, please. Just for a couple of minutes, I'd like to get a feedback from you, some of you, with some basic ideas, and just shout them out as I point in your direction, and I'm going to put you back to work again with another question. What were some of the feelings you had when you were out there in the future? Dave, give us several. You had some very distinct feelings out there. Initially, he felt sort of resigned to it, and then he suddenly realized, my word, this is exciting because I can choose. Yeah. Okay, let's get over in through here. What's some feelings you had? There was a lot of similarity on those basic needs. Very interesting. Okay, somewhere over in through here now, somebody speak up. Had you ever been out in the future very specifically and intentionally around these questions before? Some of you I know have, but had you? For how many of you, put your hand up, was this really the first time you've really been out in the future specifically? Would you put your hands up? Okay, some of you, 10, 15%. Okay. Okay, some other inputs over in through here. Anybody? Okay, so that it was your... What did you enjoy out there? What did you enjoy out there? Some new different things, okay. How about in through here, someone? Yeah. Okay, and through over in here. How did you feel when you were out there? Okay, in the back. Could you repeat that? Okay, so some of you, how many of you, when you got out there, said to yourself, well, gee, there won't even be one? How many of you felt that way? 10 or 15, okay. That's a fairly high percentage to feel that way. Well, intensely, I'm sure it crossed your mind. You know, your own Carl Bratton, who's a good Lutheran, said, to refuse to hope is an act of treason against our essential humanity. That's the one thing the future can take. The Christian can take into the future that no one else really can who's not Christian, is the capital H on the hope. To refuse to hope is an act of treason against the possibility of our redemption, both as individuals and as a society. Okay, over in here somewhere. Isn't that interesting? I had a big argument with the publishing company on thinking the future tense and about the cover. I said I wanted a statement on the bottom of the front cover. And they said, we don't do that. The only thing that goes on the cover is your name and the name of the book. I said, but this little sentence has to go on the cover because it's so important. They said, there's no way, we just don't do that. When the book was finally published, it was on the front cover. In such small letters, it takes a magnifying glass to read them, but it's on there. And I said, hooray, I won, it's on there. But anybody I've ever talked to read the book never saw it. Let me tell you what it is. What that phrase was. Seeing tomorrow as both a problem and a hope. You see, to see tomorrow only as a hope utopian kind of thing. Everything, don't worry, God's in control. It's all going to be fine and dandy. Is wrong. Seeing tomorrow as being everything's going to blow to pieces, it won't be any tomorrow, that's wrong too. We must learn how to hold these two in tension, creative tension, because it's our hope in the future of Christ that enables us to work through the problems and really to accommodate the problems. So it's that the maturity today is being able to keep those in creative tension, I believe. Over in through here, what were some of the responses over in through here? Okay, over on this side. All right, good. Yeah, that's great. That's really good. Let me try to illustrate that. When we are in the future, we can only contemplate. When we're in the present, we can act. Now, this is a sort of a philosophical concept. Let me kind of act it out here. In the act of searching out the future, you step over the boundaries of the known into the unknown future. I am now in the future. I am now in the present. I'm now in the past, okay? In stepping over the boundaries of the known into the unknown future, something very interesting happens. I'm now in the unknown future, okay? Let's for the moment say it's my future. It could be the future of the church, your church. It could be the future of your family, your business, your state, the world, your nation, anything. I'm just going to happen to pick my future only to illustrate the principle. And I'll do it in a facetious way. Okay, I'm now in the future, okay? I can't act out here, but I can sure contemplate. I'm contemplating all of the options that exist out there. So I look all around and I say it's 5 years from now. Ah, that's what I want, right there. I want to sail around the world in a schooner with my wife and drop anchor in a Tahitian bay and scuba dive. That is not my future, but let's say that that's it, okay? Now, you pick out the time period and what you want, but that's what I want, okay? That's the future I prefer. What happens? A very remarkable, amazing thing happens. I am instantly transported back to the present, where I am forced to contemplate my present actions and their impact on that future. When I get up tomorrow morning, I say to myself, gee, 5 years, I got to sail around, I better learn some navigation. Or I better start pricing out boats. In other words, you're going to be dealing in the present with that future. The future is always in the present. And if we do not have that image of the future, we have a very deprived present. The future is now. Question, what is your image of the future for your church, your job, your own life, or whatever? It's a very critical question. For example, let's take the next 24 hours as being it's now next Monday morning, and the next 24 hours is a model of your future. So I can again talk about principles. Okay, the alarm clock rings. I get up out of bed. I have certain assumptions about the next 24 hours. One assumption is my wife has bought some eggs and there'll be enough eggs for breakfast in the refrigerator. That's an assumption. Another assumption, it's not going to rain, so I don't have to take a raincoat to work. Another assumption, the car will start. Another assumption, I'm going to meet Fred for lunch. I have a whole series of assumptions about the next 24 hours, okay? And because of those assumptions, I can move through the next 24 hours with a reasonable amount of rationality. take those assumptions out of that 24 hours, I'd have an awful time trying to make it through the day. Now here's the punchline. What are your assumptions for the next 5 years for your own life, or your church, or your state, or your job, or whatever? You see, if you have not made those explicit, you're going to have just as tough a time getting through the next 5 years as I would getting through the next 24 hours without those assumptions. To be responsible, we must make explicit the assumptions we hold. And we don't do that. Certainly don't do it for our churches. It's a fantastic activity to do that. I've done that. My church asked me to come back. We'd been in this church for 16 years and moved away, and asked me to come back for the 100th anniversary to talk about this. And we had about 600 people talking about the assumptions of that future of that church and some other things. And it was terribly exciting. I'd never done it before. What are the assumptions you hold about the next 5 years? You see, if we do not go far enough back in our memory, and if we do not go far enough forward in our hopes, our present is impoverished. It's easy to go back, and I'm not against that. That's very powerful. But how many times do we go forward? The present is always impoverished if we do not know what we want for the future. In fact, the present derives its meaning and its power from the image we hold of the future. And those of us who believe that God revealed himself very specifically in the person we call Jesus Christ have a pretty neat clue about the future. He is the future made present. Now, while you're still in groups of four, I want to ask another question now. It's 1989. You're back out there in the future. I want you to talk together about where you were. Think back 10 minutes back. Where were you? Or where weren't you? Or maybe you didn't even think about where you were. But I want you to describe where you were. You think about that for a minute and then talk about it. And then we'll get that out on the floor. Yeah, see, I'm trying to stay away from suggesting anything. Ten minutes ago, when you were writing on a piece of paper the answers to all these questions, and I said, project yourself out 10 years from now. And, okay, where were you 10 years from now? Yeah, where were you? For example, when I did this, you know where I was? We've been building a cabin at the lake for 6 years with our own hands. And when I projected myself 10 years from now, I just automatically, that's where I was. No, not finished. I'm sorry about that. No, I just want to know where you were. Now, maybe you weren't any place, and that's an answer too. And if you weren't someplace, you certainly had something around you, and I want you to describe that. Okay. Let me ask one big broad question first. I'm very curious to know what this will be. How many of you, when you were in 1989, were very specifically in a geographical place that you could identify? Put up your hand. It looks like about a fourth of you, a little bit more than a fourth. How many of you were not in a geographical place, but were in an environment that somehow you were conscious of being supported in an environment? Dave here felt that he was within the body of Christ, the church, someplace. And so therefore, put up your hands on that one. Okay. That's probably the other, almost as many as the other. Does somebody want to share with us how you describe the place you were in? Just pick up a few in through here. Somebody else, anywhere. Okay. Yeah, that's neat. Boy, it's terribly important to have fantasies about the future. It really is, because that can just make the presence. Okay, okay. Does someone else have over and through here? Oh, good. She was in her own home in the living room, but somehow it was the same place, but she had a completely different feeling about it. She's seeing the place for the first time. How does that go? I'm trying to remember the quotation. It'll come to me. Someone else.
Thank you.
Did you want to break up a quarter off?
Can we?
Okay.
I'd like to
No, that's fine. Give me another last minute.
Okay. All right. Do you want to ask them if they want any particular things for you to speak to?
Okay. Yeah. I'll kind of break into groups. Read a very interesting quotation out of a very interesting book by Alan Wheelis. I open the door of my car and notice in a corner of vision an ant scurrying around on the smooth, barren surface of the concrete parking lot, doomed to be crushed at any moment by one of 1,000 passing wheels. There exists, however, a brilliant alternative for this gravely endangered creature. In a few minutes, a woman will appear with a picnic basket, and she and I will drive to a sunny hilltop meadow for a picnic. This desperate ant has but to climb the wheel of my car onto some sheltered ledge on its frame, and in half an hour be in a paradise for ants. But this option, unknown, unknowable, really yields no freedom to the ant who is doomed. And the only irony belongs to me who observes. I reflect that options potentially as meaningful to me as this one is to the ant may at this very moment also be eluding my I reflect that options potentially as meaningful to me as this one to this ant may at this moment be eluding my awareness, and so I too may be doomed. This planet looks more like a parking lot every day. Don't like that part. What's the message? The message is alternatives without awareness yield us no freedom. Alternatives without awareness yield us no freedom. The futurist is seeking to think through the alternatives. What are the options? What are the conscious perspective on those options? Are you willing to go for another 5 minutes? Let's go 5 minutes. Let me give you some questions that each of you has to answer sometime, somewhere along the line. We won't answer them here. I have answered them. I've written 50,000 words worth of answers on these questions. I'm not going to give you my answers, but we're looking for ways to penetrate into the future, not to make predictions, but to be open for the alternatives and the possibilities that are there. I hope in my time with you we can get into some technological developments that will, they've always shaped our future. You know, the Model T Ford changed things. Then when they put a self-starter on the Model T Ford, it took women out of the kitchen. Didn't it? Yeah, it caused supermarkets to come into being. They had to change the color of cars. Open up a whole new industry called the fender industry. No, that's okay. That's a put down, isn't it? No, that was a facetious one. Okay. The first question I think that we have to come to grips with is civilization as we now know it coming to an end? That doesn't mean coming to an end being blown up, but I mean, is the way we're living, our whole cultural milieu, is that going through a change? Is civilization as we now know it coming to an end? If you believe that it is, then you will observe changes that are going on with a completely different attitude than if you believe it isn't. So you better know where you stand on that and why. And where we're coming from and where we're going to. Maybe we can talk about that another time if we get time. Where have we been, where are we coming from, and where are we going to as a civilization? Another question would be, probably the most important question we can ask ourselves, and I'm trying to remind myself of it every day. Who and what is shaping my image of the future? If the image I hold of the future is the magnet that's drawing me out of the limits of the present, and I think we pretty much agreed that's true, don't you think we ought to know who it is and what it is that's shaping that image? Now, it isn't a simple answer. You can't say, well, it's TV, or it's my local newspaper editor, heaven forbid, or, you know, who is it? My minister? Some particular authors I'm reading right now? There are people shaping my image of the future now who I never even heard about 5 years ago. And I'm very conscious that that person, I read a book and I say, I know at the end of the book, that has changed my image of the future. And I'm aware of that having happened to me. But I didn't become aware of that until I started asking myself that question. Very important question. Another question would be, how predictable is the future? And are there experts on the future? Yeah, it gets to be a very complex technical question. Because there are certain things we can extrapolate into the future. We can extrapolate the right now. And incidentally, I'm going to give you one of my biases now. There's a problem far greater than the energy problem. It makes the energy problem look like something very simple. And we aren't even talking about it yet as a nation. But we're going to be talking about it in the next 2 years. And that is, we are destroying the earth. It takes, from the beginning of time up until now, we've destroyed like a half a ton of topsoil for every human being living on this earth. Right now, the state of Iowa is taking, in some places, is taking 2 bushels of topsoil to grow 1 bushel of corn. And if we continue to destroy our basic topsoil over the next 20 years, by the year 2000, at the same rate we're now destroying it, 1% of the Earth's surface will be tillable. We're just simply destroying the Earth through erosion, pushing it with fertilizers. Can't do that. The soil says, I can't hack it, and it blows away. And so we can predict the consequences of our present actions on the future. So that's predictable. But what is predictable, what isn't predictable? You have to grapple with that as a budding futurist. I see something at my left shoulder which seems to be hint to something. Okay, we'll come together again tomorrow at 8 o'clock and we'll get into it some more. Thank you.